Hitler's War by David Irving. He Who Rides a Tiger. August 1944 saw many of the intricate problems facing Hitler resolved, though not as he had wished. France was lost, Finland and Romania had defected, Turkey had bowed to the enemy's pressure and broken off diplomatic relations with Germany. Admiral Horthy, too, regarded Germany as doomed, and had begun tactical maneuvering to regain his country's lost sovereignty, once again evoking from Hitler the warning that Germany and her allies were in one boat. Or, as he put it in another context, reading Kaltenbrunner's reports on the Renegades of July 20th, quote, "He who rides a tiger will find he can't dismount," end quote. His health was now deteriorating badly. General Heinz Guderian, thus had a freer hand than his predecessors as chief of general staff. This general thrived on tough decisions. Appalled at the neglect of the frontier defenses, he issued orders for their renovation on July 27th. Quote, "All eastern Germany must become a fortress in depth," end quote. Local Gauleiters were to work on the rapid construction of defensive positions. The Pilica Line, the Nerev-Bober Line, the Vistula Line, and the Vistula Line from Warsaw northward to Danzig, with well-armed bridgeheads east of the most important cities along the river. Guderian signed these orders with Hitler's name. The Führer grumbled, but allowed them to pass, recognizing that a Russian invasion of East Prussia or the Upper Silesian industrial region would bring disaster in its train. Hundreds of thousands of men and women began digging anti-tank trenches running southward from Stulp across ripening harvest fields and farms. In Pomerania, 70,000 women volunteered. Nothing had been done in the ancient fortress cities of Königsberg and Lützen. Guderian had soon had them bristling with minefields and captured guns. Moreover, word of Hitler's continued presence in East Prussia was spread from mouth to mouth. Thus the miracle was achieved. The Red Army was halted at Augustov and Grodno, and Field Marshal Model's emancipated Army Group Center, with its fewer than 40 divisions, undertrained and exhausted, withstood for a while the weight of one-third of the entire Soviet forces along its 400-mile front line. In Warsaw, the Polish underground army rose against the Germans as soon as the Russians showed across the river. Himmler came to Hitler. Quote, "Mein Führer," he orated with determined optimism, "viewed historically, what the Poles are doing is a blessing. We'll survive the next 5 or 6 weeks, but by then, Warsaw, the capital, the brains, the nerve center of this former 16 or 17 million strong nation of Poles, will have been wiped out. This nation that has barred our passage to the east for 7 centuries and lain foul of us ever since the first battle of Tannenberg," end quote. The Reichsfuhrer ordered the destruction of the city. It was to be blown up block by block. SS General Erich von dem Bock-Zelewski fought a cruel battle against the partisans, but the Poles' commander, General Bor Komorowski, was every inch his equal and rejected every demand to surrender, despite the dawning realization that the Russian relief attack across the river would not come in time. Quote, "I wish we had a multitude of men like General Bor," exclaimed Himmler on September 21st, "and when the last Polish," that's end quote, by the way, "and when the last Polish insurgents finally surrendered 10 days later, he ordered that Bor be treated well." The Red Army had reached Tukum on the Gulf of Riga, thus cutting off Schirner's Army Group North. It was to General Eberhard Kinzel, the Army Group's chief of staff, that Stauffenberg and Beck had issued on July 20th their quote-unquote order to retreat immediately. A catastrophe would have befallen the Army Group. Bereft of artillery and ammunition, it would have been devoured. Now, however, Schirner's troops fought magnificently. Quote, "The Bolsheviks grow more useless every day," he complained in a private letter to Hitler. "Prisoners on recent days range from 14-year-olds to old men, but what is astounding is the sheer hordes of human beings," end quote. Hitler prepared calmly for the Army Group's temporary isolation. Schirner shared his confidence, thus ruthlessly stripped the entire command area of soldiers and packed them into the combat zone. Quote, "I am convinced the enemy is staking everything on one card," he wrote. "I am convinced that what matters now is to survive this phase of the battle. Then we shall have won," end quote. Still struggling with the problem of the quote-unquote Salitz officers, the personnel branch recommended that in the future, the families of German traitors should be punished as a deterrent. Hitler approved the recommendation. Farther south, Army Group South Ukraine had been becalmed since the rout of April 1944, when it had fallen back onto Romanian soil. At that time, General Schoner had blamed the OKW's General Eric Hansen, a military liaison to Marshal Antonescu. The military chaos and above all the added financial burden on the Romanian economy put a strain on German-Romanian relations. Hansen was nearly 60 and what Guderian described as a, quote, man of General Beck, but, end quote, but he had Antonescu's confidence, and thus Hitler refused Schoner's repeated recommendations for a replacement. As Hitler later in August told General Alfred Gerstenberg, the Luftwaffe commander of the Romanian oil regions, quote, we are stocking all we've got. If we lose the oil regions, we cannot win the war, end quote. General Guderian had transferred 6 panzer and 4 infantry divisions away from Army Group South Ukraine, and he had sent Schoner to Army Group North. This brought Marshal Antonescu protesting to Rostenburg on August 5th. Hitler spoke to Antonescu for hours on end, assuring him that that impressive new German tanks and guns were under construction, that a new explosive, quote, at the experimental stage, unquote, was capable of killing everybody within 2 miles of its point of impact, that he had failed to keep his promise about the Crimea and Ukraine only because of, quote-unquote, traitors in the general staff who had encouraged the decay of the lines of communication, and that pro-Soviet traitors had also procured the collapse of Army Group Center. Antonescu was unconvinced, and the discussion was sometimes heated. He assured Hitler that, quote, he would remain at Germany's side and be the last country to abandon the Reich, end quote. It was a warm summer's day as they parted. Hitler trusted Antonescu's King Michael no more than he trusted any monarch. As the column of cars moved off, he suddenly stepped forward and called out, quote, Antonescu! Antonescu! On no account set foot inside the king's castle, end quote. Antonescu stopped the car. Hitler repeated, quote, don't go to the king's castle, end quote. A sudden instinct, his famous Fingerspitzgefühl had warned him. Before July 1944 was over, Himmler had provided the army with 40 new reserve battalions. The new divisions were now called Volksgrenadier divisions, for Himmler had obtained Hitler's approval to raise a people's army, designed to attract German youth and untainted by the spirit of the older generation. Whereas General Fromm had grudgingly furnished Hitler with 60,000 new soldiers a month, by mid-August, Himmler had raised 450,000 new troops, and 250,000 more recruits were already in the barracks. When Bormann assembled the Gauleiters at Posen on August 3rd, Himmler boasted of his prowess as the new de facto commander-in-chief of the army, but he could not explain how the rambling, ill-concealed Stauffenberg network had escaped his scrutiny. Speer then spoke of how future arms production would restore Germany's freedom of action and air supremacy by December. Thus prepped and encouraged, the Gauleiters came to hear Hitler speak on August 4th. He was still unwell. One diarist wrote, quote, the Führer walked in very slowly and stiffly and proffered only his left hand. But later, when he began his speech, he loosened up and became more lively, unquote. He disclosed that he had set up an army court of honor under Rundstedt to discharge the conspirators from the Wehrmacht so that they could be tried by the people's court. Those found guilty would be hanged. Helmut Sundermann, the deputy press chief, wrote, quote, the speech's beginning was delayed a bit as the Führer ordered the prepared desk to be removed. He had a small table and a chair brought, sat down, and began to speak so softly at first that I had difficulty hearing from the back row. Then his voice rapidly rose. Quote, I always knew that shots would be fired at me one day from this quarter, but I never dreamed the blow would be struck so far below the belt, unquote. He said he was now, quote-unquote, old and shaky, not because of his fight against Germany's enemies, but because of the perpetual conflict with his, quote, with, quote, this clique which always eluded me, unquote. This numerically small but highly influential group would have been totally incapable of any real political achievements, as they were wholly out of touch with the broad public. Now we were in the position of somebody who had been poisoned. If we could surmount this crisis, then we would not be dead, but in superb health. Although he had spoken virtually nothing of substance, his speech had an obvious impact on the Gauleiters. As the senior man present, Constantine, Herr leader of the Reich Labor Service, spoke a few words of thanks to the Führer, quote, "There is only one kind of loyalty. There is no loyal, more loyal, or loyalist. There is only loyal, and that is everything." End quote. The Führer's insomnia had returned. Though he might scoff at Stauffenberg's bungling, the injuries remained very painful. Rommel's treatment of his right elbow had resulted in dermatitis and pruritus, which left it so swollen that he could not sign documents. When unsuspecting front-line generals heartily grasped his right hand and he winced at the pain. Morel was also injecting massive doses of ultraceptal, a sulfonamide-type drug of high toxicity, manufactured by one of his companies, and an oxygen bottle now stood hissing in one corner of Hitler's bunker room. Quote, "At 2 a.m., sent for by patient A, Hitler, Morel had recorded on July 24, 1944. He complained about the burns on his arm, the thick alcohol-soaked dressing applied by Dr. von Hasselbach, inflammation and swellings," end quote. 3 days later, quote, ear still bleeding at times. Führer talked about letting some blood, but his blood pressure was normal, unquote. And on July 29th, quote, "Note that since the moment the bomb blast occurred, the tremor has vanished from his leg, and the trembling of his hands is down to a minimum," end quote. As Hitler complained of a throbbing pain over his right eye on August 2nd, Morel drained off 200 cc of his patient's blood to lower the pressure. That day, August 2nd, Hitler discussed with Dr. Goebbels an unsettling predicament which had confronted him for several days. One of the pushists, Lieutenant Colonel Caesar von Hoffacher, had deliberately implicated both Kluge and Rommel in the July 20th plot. Both of these field marshals enjoyed immense popularity. It would be unthinkable to stand them before the People's Court. Hitler had sent for General Jodl on August 1st, showed him the Hoffacher interrogation report, and indicated that as soon as Rommel recovered, he would personally question him and then retire him from the army without fuss. As he said a few weeks later, quote, "He has done the worst possible thing a soldier can do under such circumstances, sought for some way out other than purely military," end quote. It was now hardly surprising that 22 of the army generals of Army Group Center had deserted to Soviet captivity in the last 14 days. Hitler and Goebbels agreed that it would be counterproductive to hold up the generals to public abuse now, in mid-battle, but the propaganda minister was ordered to withhold no details of their accomplices' treachery. The enemy had now landed 1.5 million troops in the Normandy beachhead. The attempted British breakthrough from Caumont had been checked, but American armor and troops were pouring through the breach at Avranches on the coast to Brittany. There was one obvious countermove. Quote, "We must strike like lightning," Hitler announced at a war conference. "When we reach the sea, the American spearheads will be cut off. Obviously, they are trying all out for a major decision here, because otherwise they wouldn't have sent in their best general, Patton. The more troops they squeeze through the gap, and the better they are, the better for us when we reach the sea and cut them off. We might have been able to eliminate their whole beachhead. We mustn't get bogged. We might even be able to eliminate their whole beachhead. We mustn't get bogged down with mopping up the Americans that have broken through. Their turn will come later. We must wheel north like lightning and turn the entire army front from the rear," end quote. Hitler issued the order for the attack late on August 2nd. It was to be spearheaded by General von Funk's 47th Panzer Corps. Hitler planned to employ eight of his nine panzer divisions in Normandy and 1,000 fighter planes. He sent General Varlamont to Kluge's headquarters. The generals there assured Varlamont that the attack might well succeed. During the 6th, Hitler drafted a message to Funk's troops. Quote, "The outcome of the battle for France depends on the success of the attack on the southern wing of the 7th Army. Commander-in-Chief West, Kluge, will have a unique and unrepeatable opportunity of thrust thrusting into a region largely devoid of the enemy, and of thereby changing the whole situation. End quote. While the spearheads were thrust boldly through to the sea, fresh panzer divisions were to follow in their wake and wheel north, where they would turn the enemy front in Normandy. Once again, however, fatefully for Hitler, the British codebreakers had deciphered all of the OKW's signals preparing this decisive battle. In a series of telephone conversations, General Jodl learned that Kluge was planning to start the attack before midnight, without waiting for the fighter squadrons to arrive. In addition, only four of the planned eight panzer divisions could be extricated from the battlefield in the north in time. Kluge explained that the enemy had already detected their preparations and was preparing to take the responsibility for jumping off now. Hitler mistrusted Kluge's judgment. Above all, he wanted Kluge to wait for the right weather. He sent his best infantry general, Walter Buell, to France, but it was too late. The half-cocked thrust had already begun by the time Buell arrived. The first big town, Mortain, was captured by an SS panzer division, but then the fog lifted and a murderous enemy air assault began. Kluge's grenadiers unflinchingly faced slaughter, but the tanks themselves could proceed no further. At 11 that evening, Kluge informed Jodl that he had failed. Hitler passed judgment on Kluge with one rasping sentence, as ominous as the judgment that the People's Court passed that same day on Witzleben and his fellow conspirators. Quote, "The attack failed because Kluge wanted it to fail." End quote. At Hitler's headquarters, the disaster in Normandy was openly blamed on the Luftwaffe. Hitler had not seen Goering since July 23rd. Goering still had to introduce to Hitler a successor to the fatally injured chief of staff. The Reichsmarschall recognized that his own star was waning. After the putsch attempt, Admiral Dönitz had preceded him in a broadcast to the nation, and he was no match for the new Himmler-Bormann-Goebbels triumvirate. He had therefore retired to bed. Meanwhile, until he quote-unquote recovered, General Karl Koller had to bear the brunt of Hitler's intemperate attacks. Quote, "At every conference, the Führer rants on for hours on end about the Luftwaffe," lamented Koller in his diary on August 8th. "He strongly reproaches the Luftwaffe. The reasons are our lack of aircraft, technological shortcomings, and non-completion of the replacement squadrons in the Reich, the ME-262, etc." End quote. Six squadrons of each 68 fighters had been transferred to the Reich for rehabilitation in July. Now that Hitler ordered Kluge to prepare a second attack on Avranches, a tug-of-war began over these squadrons. He instructed Jodl late on the 8th to transfer four squadrons to the west. The next day, Hitler increased his demand to six squadrons and ordered Kluge to be ready to attack Avranches again on the 11th. Quote, "The 47th Panzer Corps attack failed because it was launched prematurely and was thus too weak and under weather conditions favoring the enemy. It is to be repeated elsewhere with powerful forces." End quote. Kluge was to employ 6th Panzer Divisions in more southwesterly direction, in a more southwesterly direction than on the 7th, and General Hans Eberbach was to be in command instead of Funk, who had been on Fritsch's staff before the war and therefore could not be trusted. General Werner Krepe was finally introduced to Hitler on August 11th as acting chief of air staff. He wrote in his shorthand diary, quote, "The Führer has become very bent, with cotton wool in his ears, and he frequently trembles uncontrollably. One must not shake his hand too violently. First, the Führer asked me about my career, then spoke at length on the origins of what he called the collapse and failure of the Luftwaffe, primarily the errors of the Reichsmarschall's technical advisers, who had made over-hasty promises about the quality and quantity of new aircraft types. The air staff had probably also been deceived and, through negligence or ignorance, made false statements to him on which he, Hitler, had unhappily based his decision." He mentioned Milch, Udet, and Jeschenik in this context. End quote. Krepe swore to speak only the unadulterated truth to him. In France, meanwhile, the goddess of fortune had eluded Hitler's grasp, and she would not return. The British were still deciphering all the German orders. Suffice to say that events now overtook General Eberbach. On the 12th, the Allies captured Alencon in his rear. By late on the 13th, the jaws closing in on him, the British and Canadians from Falaise in the north and the Americans from Argentine were barely 20 miles apart. Desperate fighting ensued in the Falaise pocket. Hans Pfeiffer, Hitler's one-time adjutant, died in a blazing tank in Normandy. Hans Junge, the young SS captain who had been his orderly, was struck down by a strafing Spitfire. His wife, Trottel, was Hitler's youngest secretary. He kept the gloomy secret to himself until it was confirmed some days later, then broke it to her in person. Quote, "Ach, child, I'm so sorry. Your husband had a fine character." End quote. Bormann's letters testify to Hitler's dejection over this one episode. Field Marshal Kluge's tactics in Normandy, meanwhile, defied explanation. Despite Hitler's clear orders, he was still holding Eberbach's tank forces too far to the north. On August 14th, Hitler again ordered Eberbach to attack the American 15th Corps at Alenkon. Patton's tanks were roaming freely across Brittany. It looked like the end in France. A Luftwaffe general attending Hitler's midday conference recorded, quote, "Tense atmosphere. Fegelein, Himmler's liaison officer, dropped hints that even more generals and field marshals are involved in July 20th. End quote. That afternoon, Heinrich Himmler, conferring alone with Hitler, offered firm proof that Kluge and Rommel had been in the anti-Hitler conspiracy. Late that evening, news reached Hitler's conference that the invasion of the French Riviera was underway. Thus, August 15th, 1944 arrived. Quote, "The worst day of my life," Hitler subsequently admitted. At the morning conference, the news was that the Americans had started their big attack on the Falaise Pocket, and that Field Marshal von Kluge had disappeared. He had ostensibly set out to confer with Eberbach on whether to abandon the panzer attack on Alenkon. But he had not arrived, and an enemy radio signal was monitored asking where he was. Towering clouds of suspicion suddenly blotted Hitler's horizon. As evening came, Hitler learned that Kluge's radio truck had been silent since last signaling at 9:30 a.m., and neither Eberbach nor SS General Hauser nor SS General Sepp Dietrich had seen him. Either he was dead, gunned down by strafing aircraft, or he was at the end at that very moment secretly negotiating the surrender of the entire Western Front to the enemy. Quote, "To change our destiny by surrendering to the British and joining forces against Russia, what an idiotic notion," end quote. Hitler scoffed a few days later. At 7:30 p.m., he ordered SS General Hauser to take over Army Group B and stop the enemy onrush threatening to envelop the 5th Panzer Army. Kluge was still missing. Hitler spent a sleepless night, swallowed fresh sedatives to no available at 6 a.m., and asked for a doctor again at 11. He learned now that Eberbach's HQ had reported Kluge's arrival that night in the heart of the Falaise Pocket. There was no explanation of where he had been all day. Hitler could trust him no longer, and he radioed, quote, "Field Marshal von Kluge is to leave the danger area immediately for 5th Panzer Army HQ, from which he is to direct the withdrawal movement," end quote. Field Marshal Model, to whom Hitler had only the day before pinned the Diamonds Award, and who was already back at the Eastern Front, was recalled to the Wolf's Lair and secretly appointed Kluge's successor. He was sent by plane to Kluge with a sealed letter ordering him home. Model arrived unannounced at Kluge's headquarters late on the 17th and immediately issued orders which resulted 3 days later in the almost unhoped-for escape of the main forces from the Falaise encirclement. Kluge returned to his native village, but in a coffin, having been killed on the 19th by a cerebral hemorrhage, according to the army doctors. A second army autopsy conducted on Hitler's orders reached the same verdict. According to his chief of staff, General Gunther Blumentritt, Kluge had been shocked by the failure of his attack on Avranches on August 7th. He had sent his son to the Falaise Pocket with the words, quote, "Let nobody accuse me of sparing my son and heir," end quote. Blumentritt had last seen him on the 18th, tapping a battle chart and moaning, quote, "Avranches, Avranches, this town has cost me my reputation as a soldier. I'll go down as in history as the Benedict of the Western Front." And asterisk related to that, Ludwig von Benedict commanded the Austrian army defeated at the Battle of Königgrätz by General Helmuth von Moltke during the Austro-Prussian War in 1866. And back up. "I did my best, but that's fate for you," end quote. It seemed that an aged field marshal had faded away, his heart worn out by the burden of being both commander-in-chief West and commander of Army Group B. Hitler mistrustfully ordered SS doctors to stage yet a third autopsy. Meanwhile, Kluge's death was to remain state secret. Now, Hitler saw the strange British repatriation of Panzer General Hans Kramer just before Overlord in a more sinister light. The British must have sent him to establish contact with the plotters. Was this how they contacted Kluge? The Gestapo had already arrested Kramer in another context after July 20th. Quote, "The British have announced," mused Hitler, thinking out loud at the end of August, "that they were in contact with a German general. The officer who was probably the go-between has effectively been arrested, for other reasons already. That was the man who was to set up this thing, in these people's view of capitulating, if possible, to the British, and then marching with the British against Russia. A totally idiotic concept." End quote. In mid-August, the army had dropped its proceedings against the general for lack of evidence. Hitler, dissatisfied, ordered two more investigations. Nothing conclusive was proven about Kramer's strange mission, but British records do show that their intelligence attached unusual importance to asking each new batch of prisoners for word about General Kramer and his fate. American forces had reached the Zina on August 18th and were only 36 miles from Paris. The German army was in full flight across the river, abandoning its heavy gear in a panic-stricken scramble for the German frontier. The Luftwaffe's general Koller returned from Paris with grim reports on the moral decay of the army after 4 years of occupation. Hitler had foreseen all of this. Now his generals had their quote-unquote war of movement with a vengeance. On the 19th, he called in Keitel, Speer, and Jodl, and soberly ordered them to lay the material foundations for a new Western army, as he was planning a great counteroffensive in November, when the enemy air forces would be grounded by bad weather. 25 divisions must be raised and equipped for this. Thus was born the Ardennes Offensive. Martin Bormann steered most of the odium for the defeat onto the Luftwaffe. Hitler asked caustically how long the Reichsmarschall's indisposition might be expected to last, but it was not until August 26th that Goering reappeared at the Wolf's Lair. Meanwhile, Bormann initiated a quote-unquote Luftwaffe scandals dossier, to which his Gauleiters contributed profusely. Bombs had been shunted out of the bomb-proof stores to make room for contraband from Italy and Greece. At Recklin, the main experimental airfield, a technician tipped off Bormann that a villa was being built for the commandant at Lake Ammersee at Luftwaffe expense, and that Luftwaffe workmen were flying down to Bavaria each weekend to finish the job. Goering's sacked deputy, Milch, was accused of having fostered bad aircraft and aero engine projects for the sake of old Lufthansa business cronies. Small wonder that Hitler compared Goering unfavorably with Himmler and remarked on how the latter had conjured up new battalions for the army. General Kreipe could not even find out how many men there were in the Luftwaffe. Hitler began to think of dissolving the entire Luftwaffe. On August 17th, he telephoned Kreipe and instructed him to replace Field Marshal Spörl, the fat Luftwaffe commander in France, by General Desselock. It was typical of Hitler to have delayed this decision until now, when it was too late. The first ME-262 jet bomber squadron was still to enter service. Goering, Kreipe, Speer, and Gallant all wanted the ME-262 used as a fighter. The bomb-proof oil refineries would not begin operating until March 1945, but by December, the OKW fuel reserve would have been consumed. On August 20th, 1944, the Red Army launched its main offensive of the late summer on General Friesner's army group on the Romanian frontier. Within 3 days, the new 6th Army would be all but encircled here. But Hitler's eyes were still on France. In Paris, armed partisan bands had risen against the German garrison. The city was vital, both militarily and politically, and Hitler had issued an emphatic demand for its defense on the 20th. Every sign of bridge between Paris and the sea had already been destroyed. Hitler ordered those intact in Paris heavily defended by anti-aircraft guns, because if they fell into enemy hands, and Choltitz had not even mined them yet, then the enemy could prize open Hitler's coastal defenses from the rear and rob him of his V-1 launching sites as well. Quote, In all history, the loss of Paris has meant the loss of France, end quote, Hitler reminded Model in an order on August 22nd. Inside the city, the first signs of revolt are to be harshly put down, e.g. by blowing up entire street blocks, by public execution of ringleaders, or by evacuation of any districts involved. as only this will stop things getting out of hand. The sign of bridges are to be prepared for demolition. Paris must not fall into enemy hands, or if it does, then only as a field of ruins." End quote. In the Balkans, things were as usual in a state of flux. When Hitler's two southeastern commanders, Weichs and Lohr, came for the conference on August 22nd, Weichs brought news of a remarkable rapprochement between General Nedić, the puppet prime minister of Serbia, and Mihailović, leader of the Chetnik guerrillas, who proposed to unite in the face of the threat to the Serbs posed by Tito's communist partisans. Together they had offered to help Hitler in the Balkans if he would provide the necessary ammunition, 3 million rounds, and allow them to raise an army of 50,000 men from the Chetniks. Field Marshal Weichs proposed a modified acceptance of their terms. All Hitler's latent Austrian resentment against the Serbs welled up within him. Quote, "The Serbs are the only eternally consistent people in the Balkans," end quote. Jodl's diary quoted him as warning, quote, "They alone have the strength and ability to keep pursuing their pan-Serbian aims," end quote. Hitler's experiences in arming helpful friends had chastened him. He would therefore permit the new experiment proposed by Weichs, but only on the smallest scale. All Germany's erstwhile allies were decamping. On August 17th, Keitel had decorated Marshal Mannerheim with a high German award, but Mannerheim had pointedly responded that the Finnish people had made him president in place of Ritti because they objected to the latter's pro-German policies. At the other end of the Russian front, Marshal Rodion Melanovsky's armies were pouring into Romania. Hitler trusted Marshal Antonescu, but not the Romanian army. Indeed, only recently had he secretly authorized General Friesner to withdraw army groups south to Ukraine to the obvious best line, from Galatz on the Danube to the Carpathians, the instant the Russians attacked. On August 22nd, he ordered experts to find out if a 70-foot-wide canal could be excavated immediately, using hordes of slave laborers from the Danube to the Black Sea at Constanta. Rumors multiplied, for instance, from the air attaché in Hungary, that a coup was imminent. His envoys in Bucharest reassured Hitler that all was well. It was not, however. He was having tea late on August 23rd when his Wehrmacht adjutant Amsberg called him to the telephone. Sonnleitner, Hüll's successor, had received a call from their man in Bucharest, Baron von Killinger, saying that strange things were going on there, that Marshal Antonescu had been summoned to the royal palace and had not returned. Hitler commented to Amsberg, quote, "Why on earth didn't he listen to me?" End quote. Shortly afterward, Romanian radio broadcast a proclamation by King Michael. Quote, "The Romanian government has accepted the armistice offered by Russia and the United Nations," unquote. He had ordered his forces not to open hostilities with the Germans, but this was cold comfort for Hitler. Most of his current oil requirements were met from the Romanian wells. For a while, Hitler contemplated desperate solutions. Sonnleitner has described in an unpublished manuscript how Hitler swept into the Pact Situation Conference that evening wearing his black cloak, what the old Austrian army called a pelerine. His face pale, his eyes searching every face around the table. General Krepp wrote in his diary that evening, quote, "Telephone conversation with Ambassador von Killinger and Gerstenberg, air attaché in Bucharest, both trapped in their legation. Killinger, a complete wreck, sends greetings to the Führer. Gerstenberg suggests dive bomber attack and using the 5th Flak Division at Plesti to seize the city. I phone Hitler several times. He approves of Gerstenberg's proposals. Demands the arrest of the king. Contact established with Bucharest once more, then interrupted." End quote. The mood lifted, recalled Sonnleitner, as though the situation had already been restored. As he accompanied the Führer back to his bunker, the latter blurted out, quote, "If you only knew what it takes, when you go in and know that something awful has happened, because you can see it written on every chalk-white face, and then you've not only got to pull yourself together to find ways and means of addressing the situation, because that's not enough. You've got to muster enough eagerness and energy to coax the others around you, coax the others round so they go along with you and perhaps even do their bit to halt the catastrophe," end quote. Sonnleitner, a fellow Austrian, could see a creeping exhaustion taking hold of Hitler. From 9:45 p.m. until far into the night, the Führer's headquarters radioed orders to Romania. General Friesner was to seize the oil fields and plan ways of getting the oil to the Reich. Every German serviceman in Romania was placed at his disposal. General Hansen was to put down the putsch. The 5th Flak Division at Plusty was to occupy the capital as Gerstenberg had suggested, and Admiral Brinkmann was to seize the Black Sea port of Constanta. A pro-Nazi Romanian general was to be appointed head of the government. Hitler began his delayed evening war conference at 2 a.m. and afterward again discussed the altered Balkan situation with Field Marshal von Weichs. He had decided to abandon Greece the moment the enemy attacked. He would shift his Schwerpunkt to northern Greece. This made it vital to prevent the Bulgarians, whose defection was clearly only hours away, from seizing the railway line from Nis to Skopje for the Allies. This was the only link with Greece. At 3:30 a.m., Gerstenberg radioed from Plosti to Hitler's headquarters. Quote, "Fought my way out and took command in Plosti together with SS General Horst Hofmeyer," unquote. Both Hansen and Killinger had already given up hope. Their telephone message reached Prussia an hour later. Quote, "This is no push, This is no push by some court camarilla, but a well-laid coup d'état from above with the complete backing of the army and people," unquote. Not one Romanian general sympathetic to Nazi Germany could now be found. The Romanians controlled the means of communication. Quote, "Given the balance of forces, there is at present no prospect of a military or political success," end quote. Nevertheless, by midday, the 2,000 anti-aircraft troops were at the city's northern outskirts. Gerstenberg emphatically disowned Hansen's gloomy assessment and called down 3 bombing attacks on the city center. But he was outnumbered 4-1. The Romanians had mined the approach roads, and they were bringing up tanks and artillery. Gerstenberg captured the radio station, but without proper combat troops, he would proceed no farther. Hitler ordered more troops in. Quote, "War conference with the Führer." A Luftwaffe general, quote, "War conference with the Führer," a Luftwaffe general wrote at midday. "Everyone was busy with Romania. Hitler, very optimistic, curses SS intelligence service and foreign ministry," mimics Ribbentrop. Goebbels and Bormann also present. End quote. Using the bombing attacks as an excuse, the Romanians declared war on Germany on the 25th. Hitler transferred General Stahl, the Luftwaffe troubleshooter general who had served him well in Sicily, and more recently in Vilna and Warsaw, to take command in Bucharest. But within 4 days of his arriving in Romania, Stahl and Gerstenberg were the captives of the Red Army now debouching into the country. Baron Manfred von Killinger committed suicide as his legation was stormed. With the now hostile Romanians in the rear, Friesner's army group collapsed. 16 German divisions were wiped out in the debacle. Finland and Bulgaria trembled. From Hungary, too, came sounds of imminent earthquake that needed no seismograph for Hitler to detect. To his war staff, Hitler still radiated confidence and dynamism. Johannes Goller, a young SS captain, who now joined the conferences with the Führer as Fegelein's adjutant, jotted down his first impressions on August 27, 1944. Quote, "I am filled with the most ineffable admiration of him. He is unique as a man, as a politician, as a military commander. He radiates such a comforting calmness. But more than once I have heard him speak harshly, and each occasion was when, on purpose or sometimes out of ignorance, less than the full and brutal truth had been spoken, or even an outright lie. He seems to sense it at once. It is enormously impressive for me. What astounds me again and again is the radiance emanating from the Führer. I have seen the highest-ranking officers come to report laden with problems and worries. They always leave his presence full of new confidence and hope." In Berlin, that's end quote. In Berlin, the trials of the traitors continued. Revolted by the newsreel film of the People's Court hearing against Field Marshal Witzleben and the other putschists, Hitler sent a sharp rebuke to Roland Friesler, criticizing his behavior as the judge. Quote, "He's behaving like a ham actor instead of getting the trial of these common criminals over as quickly as possible," end quote, he told Schaub. The hangings were also filmed, but Hitler refused to see the films. When Fegelein produced photographs of the naked corpses, Hitler irritably tossed the pictures aside. Wholly in character, Hitler ordered Himmler at the end of August to provide monthly subsistence payments to the next of kin of the hanged men, to, quote, to spare them the worst hardships, as in the case of the next of kin left by those shot after the Röhm purge of June 30th, 1934, end quote. General von Scholz's feeble surrender of Paris on August 5th, 1944, made it impossible to establish a Somme-Marne position in time. Shameful words still reached Hitler of the scenes of rout and degradation in France. In one area, officers forced their cars past bridge bottlenecks at pistol point. Luftwaffe trucks laden with furniture and loot mingled with fleeing troops, while enemy aircraft leisurely raked the columns from 100 feet up with cannon and machine gun fire. Warsaw, Paris, and now Bucharest had seen disgraceful scenes. Hitler issued an angry order to his viceroys to prevent any recurrence by evacuating their staffs immediately, right now, from the biggest non-German cities. Quote, our military and civilian authorities are often living irresponsibly and opulently without the slightest warlike preparations, sometimes even surrounded by their families and female employees. Defeats at the front coupled with uprisings in the cities result in their being paralyzed the moment a crisis breaks out. The upshot is that our troops are witness to a panic-stricken headlong flight, encumbered by a disgraceful load of German and alien womenfolk, and their own or other people's ill-gotten goods streaming across the countryside. Nothing is more likely to tarnish the image of these German authorities, and thus the Reich, in the eyes of our troops and foreign populations. End quote. The loss of France gnawed at Hitler. As they left one conference, Sonnleitner heard an SS general tackle him, quote, Mein Führer, I just don't understand. I was out of Ranches with my own division and an army division. We had no enemy ahead. We could smell the sea. But we weren't allowed to attack. I said our attack was bound to succeed, but Field Marshal Kluge told us headquarters had forbidden it. We could have avoided this whole stinking mess if we had been allowed to press on, end quote. Hitler threw a meaningful glance at Sonnleitner, quote, See? It was treachery, pure and simple, end quote. Kluge was, of course, in no position to defend his reputation. His mortal remains were still at his village church awaiting burial. On August 28th, General Bergdorf, chief of army personnel, showed Hitler the long-awaited report on the third autopsy by SS doctors. Bormann noted triumphantly, quote, On the evening of August 28th, SS General Fegelein disclosed to me that analysis by the SHA, Reich Main Security Office, has established that Field Marshal Kluge poisoned himself with cyanide, and that Kluge wrote the Führer a farewell letter. Kluge wrote that as a soldier, he has drawn the consequences of his defeat, which he had predicated and dreaded all along. In Kluge's view, Germany's defeat is inevitable, hence the Führer should realize this and act accordingly, end quote. The letter was a strange amalgam of fanaticism, asseverations of loyalty, and defeatism. The next day, the testimony of his nephew proved Kluge's links with the plotters. Judge Friesler adjourned the trial to send for Kluge, not realizing that he was dead. Hitler ordered a quiet funeral with military pallbearers, but no other honors. Obviously, Kluge had tried to contact the enemy, only to see a fighter bomber destroy his radio truck. Quote, It was the purest chance that his plan was not carried out, end quote. Hitler marveled on August 31st. Quote, The army's entire actions are explicable only in this light. And there's an asterisk, also end quote. The asterisk says, The CIC interrogated Kluge's son-in-law, Dr. Udo Esch of the Army Medical Corps, on July 27, 1945. It was he who supplied Kluge with cyanide. Kluge, said Esch, had discussed with him the possibility of surrendering the entire Western Front. Quote, He went to the front lines but was unable to get in touch with the Allied commanders. End quote. Back up. Kluge, at 62, had given up the fight. Hitler, at 55, would fight on. Quote, We shall fight on if need be on the Rhine, where matters not the least to me. Come what may, we will keep fighting this fight until, as Friedrich the Great once said, one of our accursed enemies tires of the struggle. End quote. And that's it on that chapter.
Man, so many traitors.